Kia ora and welcome to Fighting for Your Mind. I'm Mary Jane, and today I am having a conversation with Ombudsman Peter Boshier on the implementation of the United Nations Convention on Rights of Persons with Disabilities. We will be talking about this and the treatment of people in detention in New Zealand. Kia ora, Peter.
Kia ora.
Peter, you are the Ombudsman. What is your role as Ombudsman?
It's a huge role. It takes in a whole lot of different and interesting spheres. For instance, the Ombudsman Act gives me power to look at state agencies, see whether people have had a fair go.
Yeah.
With official information, a lot of people want information, don't get it. The Ombudsman is the person who they turn to.
Yes.
To adjudicate on that. Then we are what's called an independent monitoring mechanism for the rights of people with disabilities.
Right.
And we have a part with others over monitoring the performance of the government with people with disabilities.
Yes.
Then a really yet further important job we do is what's called the National Preventative Mechanism.
Right.
And that's where we look, again, often people with disabilities, but not just limited to people with disabilities, but those who are in detention.
So prisons as well.
Correct. And we make sure that standards that have got to be applied to people in detention are being held up to. So a very, very wide-ranging job and a very interesting job.
So just to bring you back to something you mentioned, the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, which is sort of a lot of the focus of today's conversation. What is the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, and broadly speaking, why is it important?
Well, it asserts rights. That the real importance of either conventions or statutes is that they assert rights for people. And once, in the case of a UN convention, once a state has agreed to that treaty, we use the word acceded to the treaty, it creates an obligation on the state in domestic law to make sure that the treaty is observed. So the importance of the UN Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities is that it gives rights to people with disabilities that otherwise aren't reflected in anything which is legal. In other words, it gives grant to rights that people are entitled to insist on.
Right. So it is, do you think it's a UN, it's a United Nations document?
Yes.
So do you think an organ like the United Nations in today's world still has the power to affect change? Can something like this...
It can. And look, I think the importance of it, though, is that countries around the world vary in the attention they pay to conventions. Just because you pass a UN convention doesn't mean that the world will change or a country will do what it should. So it seems to me that the convention's like a blueprint for a house.
Yes.
But whether you build a good, sound, safe, meaningful house depends on the builder, and in this case there is the convention saying this is how people with disabilities should be treated, but it's up to the country concerned to make sure they do it. So the UN is good in that it sets up the platform. It's very much up to each country to make sure they do it.
Do you think New Zealand is doing that good job building the house?
We've started. We recognise the importance of the plan and the importance of the object. We've got some distance to go yet on the rights encapsulated in the convention actually occurring. And Article 12, for instance, ensures people are treated equally.
Equal.
People with disabilities are not necessarily treated equally. No. You will know this. So what we've got to keep doing in New Zealand is keep recognising the importance of building into things we do creating what the convention wants us to. Equality,
yeah.
It might be suitable, acceptable housing.
Right.
It might be a recognition that the way you access something, yeah. not just in a wheelchair, but read it
yeah.
and get access to it
yeah.
and understand it,
yeah.
must accommodate the disability that someone has.
Right, right. So to, you know, further unpack some of these ideas, I'd like to look at one of the reports I read on the website.
Hmm.
There was a follow-up report on Te Whare o Matarangi done under the Crimes of Torture Act. So I guess this goes to equality. The report mentions the unit continues to use seclusion rooms as bedrooms when the unit is over capacity. I think, you saw this as a problem. So why is something like this a problem, and what can be done?
So there are two separate things here. One is what can be done about it is so much dependent on funding and resourcing and a will to sort it out.
Yeah.
Our job is to draw attention to something when it's not right.
Yes.
And I think by continuing to do that here, by making sure the focus is firmly on an issue that's unacceptable, there's bound to be more interest in it. So the very yeah. sort of interview that you're doing with me now is because we have drawn attention
yeah.
to practices which are unacceptable.
Well, it seems, it's 2020. I mean, when I read that, I think it's definitely something that needs to be, as someone doing this conversation.
Time it was addressed. Bearing in mind, and the reason that it's quite a strong, robust report,
yeah.
Is that we said 3 years ago when we did our 2017 report, we drew yeah. attention to these issues, and really they hadn't much progressed.
No.
And so there are two things in particular that we drew attention to. One was overcrowding and understaffing.
Mm.
And where that happens, you just don't get a good therapeutic workplace.
No.
The second is this. Where we found it was degrading was that you can't put people who are often detained,
yeah.
subject to Section 30 inpatient orders, you've got to give them the dignity that they deserve. They didn't ask to be there.
No.
And so if they are in a seclusion room, I'm not suggesting they are secluded. I'm saying if they're in a room or a part of the ward that's not a customised bedroom, you just don't have the things that you and I
yeah.
would expect as a minimum standard. And sometimes it's not even a toilet.
No. So you talk about staff shortage or pressure on staffing. Is staff shortage and staff pressure making this worse?
Well, this was our objection when we looked at the Wellington unit. To try and get the resourcing that they wanted, given that they couldn't get, it seems, trained psychiatric staff, they were using security guards.
Yes, plain clothes.
Right. And the difficulty with that, it's a bit like quarantine facilities or anything else.
Yeah.
Unless you're trained and you know what you're doing, you don't achieve much. In fact, you could make it worse.
Yes.
So the huge difficulty is with understaffing and under-resourcing, you use others that aren't trained to do what they should do. Look, it's a bit like having a whole lot of policemen out on the beat who don't know what it's like to be a policeman.
Yeah.
You can't really do it.
Or no.
people in the army who don't know what it's like to be in the army and
so
you
it's
just make up numbers.
A security firm that isn't really equipped to be doing the job they're doing?
Correct. And look, it's not just Wellington where this was happening.
We
draw attention to things because we are conscious that in the mental health area,
yeah.
where one has to accept funding and resourcing has not been good for some time, they know they've got problems. They accept that often. And let's take, for instance, the Henry Rongomo Bennett Centre
right.
in Hamilton.
Okay.
I think they were conscious that they were not up to scratch.
Yeah.
Overcrowding
yeah.
and just didn't seem to have the ability or the wherewithal to do much about it. So what I'm saying is when you'd have inadequate resourcing and inadequate staffing. It just shows in degrading or inhumane conditions, and that's not acceptable.
So that's why you draw attention to the staffing pressures.
Correct.
So just still unpacking this seclusion. It mentions in the report that the seclusion can have considerable physical and psychological impacts. What are these impacts on the patient and how do they manifest?
Well, I think with any of us, we are social animals. Mostly we get our well-being from socialisation. That's the sort of people that we are. I think with people who have mental illness, and all I can do is draw upon A, what my inspectors tell me, and B, my own lengthy knowledge of this as a judge.
Family court.
Yeah. I think when you have a mental illness, you have needs which sometimes become more sensitised and more acute than they might necessarily be in other cases.
In a hospital?
Correct. Yeah. And so a lot of people have, when they strike difficulties, have resilience.
Mm.
When you have a mental illness, it compromises often your resilience.
Fragility.
That's exactly the word. And so I think when you, for instance, there are occasions when there is seclusion, it's bound to heighten paranoia, feelings of being cabin fever, feelings of insecurity, fragility. And then you start, if you're not careful, to have that played out in a psychotic episode. So we don't see seclusion routinely as an issue, but we're on the lookout for it.
You're on the lookout for?
For any exercise of seclusion.
Yeah.
We did comment unfavourably on a ward in Waitakere where there was someone who had been there for 2 years in the intensive care unit because it seems of an inability to find something suitable for him in the community. What we are concerned about is that it's an artificial and a challenging environment if it's that
intense.
Stark. Yes, and that intense, correct.
On the seclusion, I mean, if somebody is in seclusion, can they ask to get out of seclusion?
As far as our jurisdiction is concerned, so you probably know that a lot is at play with mental health. For instance, there are district inspectors.
Yeah.
Right. There are district inspectors. There is the ability of some to go before a judge. And there is also the ability to complain to our office if one can get that access.
Because there was an optional protocol. Was it when they had the optional protocol, somebody would have the right to complain?
Correct.
Yeah.
And they can do that.
Do people know that?
Maybe not.
Yeah.
And that's the issue. This circles right back to the whole convention that you're talking to me about.
Yeah.
And that is that people with no disability who have all the ability to communicate and all the resilience in the world will find it much easier to access a complaint channel than someone who is challenged in all sorts of respects,
psychotic.
For instance, with and with dyslexia and so on. Blind and deaf people don't have the same ready access, and you know this. Talking to someone on the phone if you're deaf isn't straightforward.
Yeah.
If you're blind and you're trying to fill out a form.
And psychotic.
Correct.
So just one last thing on seclusion. I don't know if the average person listening would know, but what does a seclusion room look like?
Very stark.
Yeah.
The idea of a seclusion room is to remove risk and remove stimulation. So the average seclusion room will have in it probably a mattress with a thick lining on the outside.
Yeah.
Most should have a toilet.
Yes.
Not all do. There is not much else.
No.
There is no TV. There is nothing that might be used by the patient.
So it's sort of just a room with a bed.
Correct.
Yeah. And do you think that idea of low stimulus is helpful in helping somebody who's in a distressed state?
Well, that's probably beyond my level of expertise.
Yeah. Mm.
All I would want to say is that the idea of someone being secluded, you would want that to be an absolute last resort.
Yeah.
You would want to feel that it's so infringing on your dignity and your right for socialisation that you'd only want to do that for a minimum period and in extraordinary circumstances.
So you don't think that seclusion rooms are being used as punishment or for coercion?
We've not seen in any of our mental health inspection and monitoring work evidence of that.
So how about, you mentioned, you know, about equality for people with disabilities in society, you know, to have, I guess, a life as close to somebody who doesn't have a disability. But talking about inequality in a hospital for Māori and Pacifica, do you find Māori and or Pacifica people are being treated more heavily than Pākehā or white patients?
Well, I don't think that's the question that, that I'd want to answer. What I would say to you is this, because I'm not sure that we look for that, but I tell you what we do look for.
Yeah.
Routinely where there are Māori in prisons, and everyone knows that the incarceration rate for Māori percentage-wise is way higher than for Europeans.
Yeah.
So what we're looking for is good cultural programs.
Yeah, well, I was just wondering if somebody, some people are having like cultural misunderstanding and not understanding the sensitivities of different culture, different cultures.
I actually think it goes further than that.
Okay.
I think we have a right and a responsibility. It's more a responsibility than a right. We have a responsibility for Māori in prisons to understand their culture and enhance it.
Yes.
I don't think we should be having Pākehā prisons with no accommodation of Māori culture.
A colonial system.
Correct. That won't achieve anything for us moving forward, both in terms of our overall society and, more importantly, rehabilitating that person.
And putting right the you know, the Treaty of Waitangi, and it, as I've read in your reports, comprehensive reports, you know, not essentially following the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi and the impact that's had.
Yes, but I want to make an important point on this.
Yeah.
Prisons should be part of the community and should be an institution that's not just there to incarcerate, but to work on that person, in terms of what's important to them and their rehabilitation. So, for instance, if you take Ngāwhā Prison in the far north, that was built on a promise that it would involve iwi in the way it conducted itself, in the sorts of programs it had, in the tikanga, which is essential to te ao Māori.
Yeah.
Has it happened?
Yeah.
Not in accordance with the promise that was made, and that's why we were critical in a report a year ago that it needed to do more.
Still, you know, on this idea of prisons and psychiatric institutions, I read in one of your reports, it was Making Disability Rights Real, that it said the Mandela Rule explicitly prohibits the placement of prisoners with physical and mental disabilities in solitary confinement, yet it is taking place, is it legally, in psychiatric wards? And, you know, how can that happen in the same country where, I mean, a prisoner can't be put in.
I think that's a difficult question for me to answer, because what we are looking for when we monitor mental health units is not so much the efficacy of clinical treatment. We don't get into that. We are more interested in the conditions according to the convention, the optional protocol of crimes against torture. So what you're asking me is probably a different sort of question and requires a different answer than the things we're looking for.
So let's keep on, because you did under the Crimes of Torture Act, and it's I have quoted from one of your reports I've read, an act of torture is defined by an act of omission by which severe pain or suffering, whether physical or mental, is intentionally inflicted on a person. Can you answer this? Are mental health facilities cruel or degrading?
Yes. And we've found that. That's the very thing. See, let me, though, deal with torture.
Yeah.
It is very, very high threshold, and we've during my time here, we have never found evidence of torture.
Right.
Because that's a physical or mental act for a purpose. You're doing it on the definition to achieve something of a mischievous intent.
So you've never seen someone do that?
We have not.
No.
So the nearest we got to practice of a degrading inhumane nature,
yeah,
which we didn't find to be torture because it's such a high threshold,
yeah,
but we were the most critical of inhumane or degrading treatment, yeah, over tie-down beds.
Mm.
And that's where a prisoner in a prison, yeah, was being tied down for 16 hours a day,
right,
on 37 consecutive nights.
But that could almost be torture, I mean...
Well, unless you're doing it, though, with,
yeah,
the specific reason,
yeah,
that the definition requires, it doesn't reach the threshold of torture.
Okay, well, just... So let's talk about how we reached the threshold for cruel or degrading. Could we talk about that?
Yes. Whereas torture has a very, very strict prescriptive definition in, yeah, the convention, cruel or degrading...
Yeah.
Or inhumane doesn't. It leaves it open to us to decide whether something comes within the category of cruel, inhumane, or degrading. And really what we try and do is apply our common sense,
yeah,
and our sense of dignity to this. So can I give you an example?
Sure.
Some prisoners are required to do their ablutions on toilets,
right,
where they can be looked at on TV monitors.
Yeah.
I find that degrading.
I don't find that torturous.
Yeah. So that to me is degrading.
Mm.
For someone to be put into a room, as happens in some facilities, where it's a seclusion room and they can be seen by everyone walking past and there is no privacy, that to me is degrading. So, and in the case of the prisoner being restrained that I talked to you about before, that's got to be cruel.
Yeah.
How could that be anything other than cruel? So you see, often what we see just fits the natural definition because we just know it when we see it.
So do you have the power, coming back to the strength of the UN and the Disability Convention, is so really you can draw illuminate it in your reports is how does change come about?
That's a good question. It's a very good question. I think that people take a great deal of notice of the Ombudsman.
Yeah.
And the more we get our credibility in this work higher and higher, the more people will want to have regard to what we're saying, and they don't like being told off. So whereas in real coercive situations, yes, like police who can arrest people,
yeah,
we can't do any of that. But when we file a report in Parliament and we draw attention to a practice that's unacceptable, it does achieve change because ministers don't like it, ministers of the Crown don't like it, chief executive don't like being criticised.
Yeah, okay.
And people like you ask questions about it and want to know why it's carrying on. So change can occur if we're willing to be honest, principled and robust about things we see.
So let's, keeping on about the rights of persons with disabilities, the Bill of Rights Act 1990... Does it say that someone can refuse the right to undergo medical treatment? In a secure psychiatric facility, that right, does that get waived?
Well,
so I'm sort of trying to say here is that there are rights in the Bill of Rights Act that the average person will have, but if you end up in a facility, I don't know, a prison or a psychiatric facility, those rights like the right to not undergo medical treatment. You don't have that right.
That's because the Bill of Rights, it's a good question. The Bill of Rights Act has to be read alongside other bits of legislation. So what the Bill of Rights Act says is that you've got certain rights, but they are subject to other prescribed, compromises to those rights. So can I give you an example? If you are subject to an inpatient compulsory treatment order, that will give the responsible clinician the right to medicate you, whether you like it or not. In the case of electroconvulsive therapy, that is permitted out of the 1992 Compulsory Assessment Treatment Act, but it's got its own
procedure. I do ask a question about
that. Sure. Well, that's got its own extra safeguards in because it's such an invasive procedure. So the answer to your question about Bill of Rights is, yes, that's the starting point, but it's subject to other legislation and other law.
So, you know, as I've read your reports, I mean, I see that really your team and your work is to bring, mental health and people with disabilities, like, just, you know, get a bit of movement happening. So talking about contemporary mental health philosophy, does something like, you know, medical treatment as a compulsion or as compulsory, how does that stand in contemporary mental health philosophy?
Well, you've picked on a good topic. The Bill of Rights Act was 1990 and the Mental Health Act was 1992. And 1992, when you look at the movement of social justice and law, is a long time ago. So what may have been fit for purpose in 1992 may now not be fit for purpose. And I think there is a feeling that the 1992 Mental Health Act is what I will call too paternalistic.
Yeah.
In other words, the state dictates what's good for the person and what's not good. I think now there is a better acceptance that that is too coercive and doesn't properly give effect, for instance, to the Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities. So just because you've got a disability shouldn't mean that you unfairly and improperly give way to your rights, for instance, under the Mental Health Act. So you'll see that I think there is a feeling that the law now has to evolve and make mental health less coercive and more individualistic.
So to continue on with this idea of contemporary mental health philosophy and the evolution, the report, back to your report, Making Disability Rights Real, mentioned Māori needs self-determined solutions. What does that mean in a mental health realm?
Well, Māori have the concept of wairua and spirituality within Māori is hugely important, and solutions that Māori have, for instance, even physical medicinal medicine, very, very different to what you and I, if we are both non-Māori, very different to what we have been brought up on and treated with. So I want there to be a respect that culture that has its own inherent way of rehabilitating is given the ability to do so. And I think under the Treaty of Waitangi, I think there have got to be good observances within Māori of their wish to treat and rehabilitate according to Te Ao Māori.
Continuing on the same report, Making Disability Rights Real, I mean, looking in the past times in the Māori world, an impairment, say, or a disability, mental health impairment, could have been seen as a godlike power, yet Western psychiatry, I think, would label, you know, could be quicker to label such power as grandiose. Can a balance be struck for all service users?
Well, you see, that's you and I were talking before we started the interview proper about the fact that you're a writer. And You wouldn't want writers to all be boring and never suffer from grandiosity. How is it that some writers like Spike Milligan and others, are such interesting people. They have been severely, I mean, he's dead now, but a number of highly competent, creative, wonderful artists have mental health issues and challenges. So what's grandiosity to them is just to us is creativity to them.
Yeah.
So I'm fairly guarded in being too critical.
So are you almost saying one could celebrate these different ways of seeing the world?
I think we have to.
Yeah. So then let's talk about the psychiatry model. I mean, you talked about the Mental Health Act last done in 1992, and might be time to evolve from something less paternalistic. What about updating the psychiatry model to be more inclusive of non-white cultures and non-white approaches to health, I mean, for the whole system?
Anything that promotes and enhances New Zealand's growing diversity is a good thing. And I'm not just talking now about the Treaty of Waitangi and how important it is to accommodate what that treaty requires. But if you look at the parliament that's just been elected and the diversity now that we have amongst MPs that just was not there when I was a child,
right. We
now must accept that they're all part of New Zealand as a wider variety of languages, a wider variety of culture, and that's going to mean the way we want to treat someone is one way of treating them, but we've got to get used to the fact that diversity means we've got to look more broadly.
So do you see a future where legislation can consider Māori, titiriti, different cultures and you know, multiple worldviews being integrated?
Look, I think the answer to that is...
It's legislation.
It is, but I want to definitely play my part while I'm the ombudsman in extending fairness to all. And fairness to all means, passionately to me, that you must apply the law and practice according to the person in front of you, not just because, broadly speaking, we think that this should happen and fairness should mean such and such. Fairness must mean, to a great degree, what's fair for this person in their situation.
Yeah.
And I just want to develop this for 10 seconds. That must mean that if you have a disability, the agency dealing with you must accommodate that. And if they don't, it seems to me, I will say so and call it out.
Right. So do you think people with lived experience, whether Māori, non-Māori, Pacifica, in reading your reports, do you think people with the experience have a part to play in mainstreaming these disability convention ideas and the eventual implementation into law?
Yes, because for someone like me that has not lived in the disabled world, how can I truly understand it?
Right.
Now, I can try, and I should always try. But the disability community that I work with, look, since I started this job, I've had so many insights gifted to me that I never had as a judge.
Yeah.
It's because of my work in the independent monitoring mechanism, and I've learnt to a certain extent to talk in sign language.
Okay.
I could never do that before.
Yeah.
So I think that the answer is we must evolve and develop, and we must do it at an accelerated pace.
Yes, you talk about a quantum leap needed in some areas.
Yes.
So let's coming back to mental health issues. Did you call for the repeal and replacement? You talked about updating the Mental Health Act and compulsory treatment orders under the Mental Health Act, I think, contravene the Disability Convention. Can change happen in the near future?
Well, I understand in the heavy legislative program that there always is, that there is interest in revisiting the Mental Health Act and making it more attuned to, for instance, what the Bill of Rights Act really implores us to do, and to make it less heavy-handed with those who have a disability. And, and specifically, of course, it refers to mental, not intellectual.
Yeah.
And with those with a mental disability, it requires that the threshold is you must be a danger to yourself or to someone else. The problem with it is so far so good, but then it requires an order to be made. And then according to the order, the responsible clinician has quite wide powers.
Yeah.
I think the feeling is that this should be a more stepped process and not as compulsive and not as coercive.
The process of treatment.
Correct.
How does repeal and replacement happen in the realm of major mental illnesses? Like someone, say, for want of a better word, psychotic or in their own world, having a very vivid, very real experience, so different to the rest of how the world around them. How does that happen? How can repeal and replace happen in that realm?
Well, you're probably getting more into psychiatry.
Okay.
And you probably know more about this area than I do.
Well, no, I just wondered how you could use a less coercive approach, a less medical approach, and, you know, apply some more progressive principles to, I guess, changing the law and then changing treatment.
Well, can I just answer that in this way? I think that we should be more understanding of what mental illness is.
Yeah.
Just because someone's talking to themselves or they're thrashing around does not mean that we need to inject them with something.
No.
I'd like to feel, yeah. So in the past, if someone limped or had a disability in the old days,
yeah,
maybe we were less understanding and less compassionate. And I'd like to feel now that when someone encounters someone with a disability, they treat them with equality.
Yeah.
And that means that if they need to help them, they will, so that they get an equal result. I think with someone with a mental illness, I'd like to feel our understanding is that we are less threatened and less coercive in our response than we used to be in pretty dim, dark days of mental treatment in this country.
So really, for something like that to happen, there may have to be a bit of a broadening in the spectrum of training.
Sure.
In a report, it mentions a substituted decision making and supported decision making. Are you able to explain to me what substituted decision making is and supported decision making, and which is better?
I'll give it a go.
Okay.
But these are quite technical, and to get it right,
I don't think many people would.
No, look. I think that what substituted decision-making and supported decision-making means is this. Instead of taking off someone the right to make an informed decision, you help them make a decision.
Mm.
Now, at the moment, it's very difficult to do that.
Mm.
It's quite... The mental health process is fairly stark and fairly formal and probably quite intimidating.
Mm.
And although it's meant to involve a model of family being there to support, I didn't see much of it when I was a judge. So I think what disability rights is looking to try and achieve is someone who has difficulty being supported and having, as far as substitution is concerned, I think perhaps the notion is that in place of...
Someone else makes the decision.
Correct.
Yeah. Right, so that could be helpful for somebody who is in their own world or psychotic. Not everybody would see it as a psychosis. Some people might see it in another way, but yes, just trying to, I guess, reach the person.
The interesting thing about the very thing you're talking about is that for those who are religious...
Yeah.
And it's Saul on the road to Damascus, and he was converted by seeing Christ and a vision.
Saul?
Yes.
Yes.
So he became St. Paul as a result of his conversion to Christianity. Now, you wouldn't want to confuse the Bible and its notion of people having visions with someone who was mentally ill and thought they saw a vision, so we locked them up. I mean, we've got to be consistent in what we're saying is good and what we're not saying is good.
But if we look at a medical world, I mean, it would be a judgment to say that all people in the medical world couldn't fathom a spiritual realm, but there is a crisis between the science and the art and the spirit. I mean,
sure.
Do you see a future where there could be a deinstitutionalization of care in mental health and the disability industry?
You used the word institutionalization, and I'd love us to not have that word.
Yeah.
When in 1992 we closed down places like Carrington, Lake Alice had been closed before that time. That was meant to be
the
end to institutionalization. I think what we're finding in some of our reports that we see that they're so overcrowded and so under-resourced that there is an element of institutionalisation.
Yeah.
So I just want the model. I want people to have somewhere to go if they need mental health intervention. But I want it to be helpful, therapeutic, humane.
And rehabilitative.
Correct.
So we talked a little bit about ECT, because in your reports I noticed you often say I found no report of ECT. But still, is ECT in New Zealand being used in a compulsory way?
I can only tell you what my very limited experience is as a judge.
Okay.
We have not, first of all, in none of the reports that have come my way, as the national preventative mechanism, I have seen no criticism or evidence of use of ECT.
Okay.
So it hasn't featured.
Okay. No ECT?
I'm not saying that. I'm saying when we look and do an inspection of records practice, we are not seeing any evidence of it.
Okay.
Whereas we have seen evidence of some other things, such as use of restraints.
Yes.
And use of tie down beds. So that used to happen.
Yeah.
In terms of my role as a judge, I knew that we were very cautious and guarded about ECT, but I knew that it was a practice that existed.
Mm.
Your question is against someone's...
Is it compulsory? Can it still be used compulsory? Like, you have to undergo this, you know, like how other treatments are compulsory under the Mental Health Act?
To the best of my knowledge, if you are subject to an inpatient order...
Yeah.
And the responsible clinician and one other supports the use of ECT.
Yeah.
My understanding is it can be administered whether you like it or not.
Right. Mm. Do you think in that case that people with acute mental health, and the report I have read had been on acute mental health facilities, do you think people are invisible in there?
I've seen no suggestion of people being invisible. I have to say to you that what my inspectors do in mental health units in particular is a pretty thorough inspection of not only who they see, but of records.
Yeah.
Your question is, are there people that we don't know about? As far as I know, that does not happen.
Do you think the Mental Health Act legitimises cruel or degrading treatment?
It certainly doesn't.
Might not set out to.
It certainly doesn't legitimise it.
Okay.
What's meant to happen, and what we've been critical of, is good practice isn't always observed. So if you take, for instance, the Auckland case that we talked about before, he should never have been in an intensive care unit for the time he was. So I don't
In 2 years in Waitakere.
Correct.
Yeah.
So I don't think the Mental Health Act legitimises it, but it certainly doesn't promote, to the extent we want to, good practice.
So there's lots of talk in the media about shortage of beds. You know, mental health is booming. You know, there's a crisis of anxiety, I think, you know, and depression. And you mentioned that you felt like someone needed a place to go if they're experiencing, you know, mental distress, or that something is going wrong, had a crisis in their life, you know, got depressed, had a anxiety, got triggered. Does I guess maybe looking in this realm now, does more beds mean more mental health? More mean more?
Well, again, that's a good question, because could you say that the more beds you supply, the more mental health will be institutionalised?
Yes.
I don't know. I really don't know the answer to that. I'd hope not. I'd hope that if more beds are to be secured, and by that I mean put online and made available, I just hope it stops overcrowding.
Yeah.
Look, with the forces at work of COVID-19 and the number of things at work for New Zealanders, there will be those with mental health that need intervention. Yeah. I accept that.
Mm.
What we're trying to do in this office is make sure that...
Make it more humane.
You've got it. Yeah. I can't say it better than that.
No. So we're still on the Disability Convention. Just to refer to an article, Article 28 of the Disability Convention talks about continued improvement of living standards and housing. Housing was one of your key issues in that report, Making Disability Rights Real. New Zealand is officially in a recession, I think. How can we, for people with major mental health and disabilities in this COVID world, how can there be a continued improvement of living standards?
Mm. But there has to be.
Yeah.
And I know that we are in a recession. I know that we've borrowed billions of dollars. I know all that. But my job, and this is why New Zealand has an ombudsman, my job is to maintain dignity and maintain standards.
Mm.
And I'm not saying that I should regard as irrelevant COVID-19 and the huge financial pressure this country is now under. Of course I acknowledge it, but I'm not prepared to compromise what the convention requires, and Article 28 should be used to continue to improve the housing ability for people with disabilities. But that's what it says. My job
but
is to keep...
Because already you say in the report people with disabilities are in poverty.
Correct. And well, they are. And that's because they just don't necessarily have the resilience and the channels available to them.
And inequality of opportunities and many, many things.
Yes.
So to go back now and just to come to the issue of women, not the issue, but the topic, the subject of women, you talk a lot about, in that Making Disability Rights Real report, about not enough stats, and it mentioned in the report police don't collect disaggregated stats on sexual and other violent crime towards women with disabilities. And is this something you think needs to be obviously done?
Yes. Look. What our whole point about disaggregated
stats.
Thank you, disaggregated. I can't even say the word. Our point about disaggregated data is that there's no point in collecting generic data.
Yeah.
If you want to know what lies behind the data. For instance, let's say that in Wellington Central, let's say that 1,000 people complain to the police of an attack.
Yeah.
But it depends on...
the motivations.
Yes, it depends on who was attacked. Were they of a certain type?
Yeah.
Does it mean that certain people are honing on certain victims? Now, if they are, your response has to change.
Yeah.
So the whole point about disaggregated data is knowing a whole lot of things.
Variables.
Correct. And I want to know, through disaggregated data, whether people with disabilities are featuring in certain areas, for instance, of being victims. And if that's so, what are we doing about it? We won't know that until we have the right data.
Still on the topic of women, in the Making Disability Rights Real report, disabled women, it mentions disabled women wanting to escape a violent situation are often not believed and are often perceived as asexual. Is that just a case of discrimination? I mean, that's to me that how can help reach this vulnerable group?
Well, this is where I think that law enforcement agencies, and for that matter, agencies like mine, must take people as they find them.
Yeah.
We must not get into a situation where we are prejudging someone's credibility or veracity by what they look like or how they talk.
Yeah.
And I think that what we were trying to say in the Disability Rights Real Report is we want frontline law enforcement people to be alive to the fact, take a step back and don't assume anything. Yeah. Don't assume that because someone mightn't be able to articulate.
Engage.
Correct.
Yeah.
Don't assume they're intoxicated. They may well have a motor neuron disease. Yeah. And I think this is where we've just got to continue to...
Well, they might be having a panic attack.
Correct.
Yeah.
Just got to keep at this.
Okay. Do you think the dialogue around mental health and suicide could be more open?
Yes, I do. When I was at the Law Commission, we did a substantial report on what should be reported about suicide. There are varying points of view. The greatest force at work against detail is copycatting.
Against what, sorry?
Copycatting.
Yeah.
It comes to suicide.
Yeah.
And so you have to be careful, I think, on the way you approach suicide. But I'd rather be more open about what's going on in New Zealand than closed. I also accept that with suicide, there should be an acceptance of privacy and dignity of the person's family. But the problem is we speculate and we miss opportunities if we are not reasonably open about what's going on.
Do you feel like if there was a more open dialogue around suicide, say people would... I don't know how you'd make it more open, but do you think people might be less likely to take their life?
I don't know the answer to that. What I would say is that the more we talk about cyberbullying, what we do know is that a number of people, and I think it's common knowledge that the socialite Charlotte Dawson... took her life as a result of being cyberbullied.
Yeah.
We talked about that openly, but I think there are a lot of teenagers that are cyberbullied and it's not talked about.
Yeah.
I just think that it does not achieve anything if we pretend that this is not a big social issue and we push it to one side. We're ignoring opportunities. Right. We've got to take opportunities to get this right.
Okay. So coming to the end now.
Yeah. You've done very well with time.
What do you see as the long game for mental health? In your opinion, with the ratification of the UN Convention, what do you think is the medium to long-term vision for mental health care in New Zealand?
Well, can I give you 1 minute on my own philosophy about this?
Sure.
I want mental health illness to be known and seen as an illness like any other illness.
Yeah.
It should not be a lesser important form of illness and one which doesn't have as much resource and importance.
So
it's easy to regard... high-powered operations on the brain and the heart and other parts of the body as a really important aspect of health, and to push mental health right down the ladder.
Yeah.
We must not do that. Mental illness is a part of our health system that's entitled to the same recognition as the other glamorous parts of the health system. And I think if we've got a social conscience and we believe passionately in this country about equality and doing the right thing, we've got to give special attention to those who have a disability and who are in the mental health system, because they don't have the ability to speak up for themselves.
Mm. So do you feel positive in that case about the future of mental health in New Zealand?
I feel positive because people like me will speak about this. We know about it. We know what we're doing. And this office will continue to grow in making sure that the UN Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities actually is put into effect, and we call it out when it's not.
Thank you, Peter. And that was New Zealand Ombudsman Peter Beauchere. Thank you for listening to Fighting for Your Mind. Tēnā koe.